welcome to episode 11 of the Alec Hogg Show, a long-form audio biography where we delve into the lives of interesting South Africans. Our guest in this episode is the independent-minded economist, Chris Hart. A former science teacher who did a BCom because he thought it would help when one day he became a headmaster, that degree instead was a ticket into a bank's dealing room. Hart's innovative approach to interpreting economic data helped the traders he advised to make a packet through his contrarian forecasts that more often than not trumped the consensus. He hit the headlines almost 5 years ago when targeted by political interests ahead of South Africa's fractious 2016 municipal elections. This gentle giant refused to be bowed by a social media mob that itself was fueled by the noxious and unlamented Bell Pottinger. Not so the corporation, which only 3 months previously had headhunted Hart because of his independent mindset. It blinked and he was gone. It's a fascinating story of a life punctuated by personal challenges, including the murder of his identical twin brother. Yet Chris Hart remains in the service of his less fortunate fellows and an inspiration to the rest of us. Here's his story.
I taught for about 13 years. I was a career teacher. When I qualified, I actually then studied a BCom because I thought, well, in education, you get promoted into management and, you know, ultimately not into your speciality.
How did you get into teaching in the first place?
I actually wanted to teach. My father was also a teacher. I grew up on a teacher's salary on the East Rand in Boksburg.
I have to say, it's so quietly. Isn't Charlize is from Benoni. That's like the Houghton of Boksburg, isn't
Something
it?
Something like that, yes.
And before that?
Primary school was in Benoni, and in high school I went to a school called King Edward High School, which was apparently a very good high school.
Extremely well known.
Yes.
But then you go into teaching.
Yeah, I taught at JP. I left JP after about 9 years on promotion as head of department at Glen Vista High School.
Now, also reading through the various pieces that there are on the internet, it said that while you were at JP, so was Jake White.
That's correct. We started our careers together. It was the bottom prefab. He was in the one and I was in the other. That's where we started.
Are you still in touch with him?
No, not really. It's a pity, but you know, Jake White, I always thought, was one of the most outstanding rugby coaches. He could put a team together. He had an eye not necessarily for individual brilliance, but how people fit together in a team. And that's why I think he succeeds as a coach.
It's interesting to note that you both started off as teachers and you also achieved great prominence in your own career. And we know Jake White coached the Springboks to win the World Cup. Is that a route that you're seeing more and more from people who perhaps start off as educators and then do something else?
Well, one of the things I found as an educator, you sit there and you think, what else can I do? You almost get trapped in that environment, but people who move out of it tend to do very, very well. I remember moving into the dealing room at EPSA, and they were all looking at me and saying, you know, my personality, you know, would I fit in with that stress? And I can remember a few months later, I thought, where is the stress that they're talking about? Because teaching is a very, very stressful. It's one of the most stressful careers you can actually do. And that's on a measured scale. I think air traffic controller might beat it and that type of thing. But I think the reason is that you are dealing with people all the time, pushing, pushing, pushing. And that's what actually puts the strain and, you know, stress on it. So the career I went into in terms of economics and doing presentations to groups of people, that suited me very, very well. You know, the one thing I didn't have to do when you actually doing presentations and tell people to sit up, do your tie up, have you done your homework,
etc.
Pay attention. So all of that stress was gone. So really something I could really flourish and enjoy it.
Were you a good teacher?
I'm not sure. Okay, I rate myself as a reasonably good teacher. Where I thought my real speciality was not really getting the good kids through, but actually taking the weaker kids through, because I really believed from a subject point of view. I taught physical science. It was a compulsory subject at JEPI, and at Glen Vista I pushed to keep it as, you know, that you must take at least one of the sciences. If it's not physical science, at least biology. And the reason I had for that is that you can study anything at tertiary level. You do not have to have studied it at primary or secondary level. You can start from scratch with any subject except maths and science. If you haven't done that, you've closed your doors to a whole universe. And that's why I would always encourage people to stick with maths and science, even if you're struggling. And with all your other subjects, take what you like and what you enjoy. It really doesn't matter on your subject choices. But on that, you know, my efforts, particularly at JEPI, where it was compulsory, where kids had been taken out of maths and put into business economics, I still had to try and get them through matric. And I think that was where my strength, is to actually get the weaker kids through.
It's quite depressing, Chris, what you've just said now, because South Africa's record in maths and science is pretty awful.
It is pretty awful. And I think very often the kids land up in, you know, what I know is standard 8, grade 10, 11, where the mathematical ability, the bus has already gone, because we haven't had the proper grounding.
Any regrets about leaving teaching? You've had a tumultuous career.
No, not at all. I think, firstly, by the time I'd finished teaching, I was getting bored with it. You know, so I was already at the career stage where I was, if I'd stayed, I'd have become a deputy headmaster and more into the managerial and administrative side of the school rather than actual teaching.
So you join APSA.
Yes.
You're now in the commercial world. You're now with a bunch of traders at a major bank in South Africa. Did they listen to you from the outset?
No. In fact, one of the most interesting experiences, being introduced into the dealing room on day one, met the senior trader who was very, very off colour. He was sitting in his chair, didn't even get up. He looked up at me and said, "Now, why the hell should I listen to you?" And that was one of the best questions. I said, why the hell should he listen to me? He's a veteran trader. He's been there. He's done that. You know, what value can I add? And that was a really good question to have to answer. We eventually got on very, very well because I think I could step up to the plate and actually deliver something that he would want to hear from me. I think I had an advantage in the sense I had an economic background and also had a science background. And the economics is very much model-driven, where you try and understand reality through a model and you build the model and you explain the model. And if it doesn't meet with reality, you try and manipulate reality back to your model. And in the physics world, you've got the cause and effect. You know, you do this and that happens. You do it again and it gets repeated, etc. That's physics. And I think that combination of thinking helped me to look at this world of markets and economics and the interface in a different way. And I can remember in 2001, and I'd picked up a particular relationship in the market which was not with the economics. The economics is you raise interest rates and the currency strengthens, you cut interest rates and the currency would weaken. And I was actually picking up that the rand was behaving exactly the opposite. The rand had blown out to 12 rand 80, the awful level of 12 rand 80 at that stage, and it started to come back. And we were on the verge of interest rate cuts, and there was that whole controversy about whether the CPI was measured correctly, and they actually had an adjustment to CPI, which is never done, okay, but they actually adjusted it backwards and they cut interest rates at the next meeting. And my prediction was they cut interest rates and this rand is going to start strengthening. It's going to strengthen on a fairly long-term basis, because cutting strengthen, lower inflation, more cutting, etc., it would be a self-reinforcing trend. And of course, that is exactly what happened. So I was one of the two economists that were predicting interest rates that were coming down lower and further than expected. I can remember when I was doing in an MBA class, and the lecturer was just showing what the market is saying about interest rates and showing that the next move in interest rates is going to be up according to the market, and everybody looked at me and said, what do you say? I said, the next move is down. Okay, and we had two more cuts after that because we were actually going what was against people's life experience of permanent rand weakness. So you couldn't get your mind around rand strength. You know, that's where I really made my name, is at that particular point.
Swimming against the tide.
Yeah.
Thinking differently.
It's thinking differently, but also prepared to say it publicly, because I think you in the general economics, as you say, what's the consensus? I'm away from consensus. I need to readjust my thinking. You know, people don't back themselves. It doesn't mean that you're always right.
But you've never had a problem with that, with backing yourself?
No, I don't. I think the reason is, in the dealing room, we already had the dot-com bubble that had burst, and the scandal on analysis, where you had an analyst coming along and saying, backing this and buy this, and in private saying this is a piece of rubbish. And clearly they had a different private view to the public view that they had. And I said, in the dealing room, the dealers already know the house view. They want to know what my view is. In fact, they insisted on that. So I can't go to their customers and tell them a different view, hiding behind a house view type of thing. Certainly not in a dealing room environment.
Were you successful?
Yes. The senior management at APSA actually backed me. And I think partly because I was right. I was getting the rand right and I was getting interest rate right at that time, which meant that, you know, the house view was struggling from that point of view.
You're listening to the Alec Hogg Show from BizNews. You mentioned the MBA, and there's quite a lot spoken about that. Another controversy of yours was your qualifications the time that the whole Twitter sphere went crazy about you. But tell us the story there. You grew up as a twin.
Yes, I was an identical twin brother and started on the path of the MBA, and I was doing okay in that. And then the time came to do the dissertation, and that was at that point my brother was murdered. And that was an exceptionally difficult time at in my life, as you can appreciate. And I then did not complete the MBA. All right, so that was one of the things that I could say in my life. I'm saying, okay, it would have been nice to have finished, but I've never felt as though I haven't been able to function because I haven't had it. I've certainly got sufficient, but certainly in terms of qualifications, I think one of the issues was that I've never made it an issue, and then somebody that tried to make it an issue, and there's never been a problem. I've got a high diploma in education, in science teaching, that's a four-year thing, and a BCom, which is 3 years, at 7 years post-matric studies. The MBA I've never claimed as a qualification.
But let's just get back to that. Your twin, were you guys close?
Very, very close. We did almost everything together. He worked for Receiver of Revenue. I can't help thinking that it may have been a hit because of the nature of what happened. He was literally a single shot, side of the road, nothing stolen. It had all the hallmarks of a hit type of thing.
You must have investigated. Did you turn anything up?
Let's put it this way. That's when you really learn the issues of service delivery, and that's our police pay more attention to recovering traffic fines than they do to actually investigate anything of a criminal nature. And we can see that even with the corruption, etc. I've got very little...
When it happens to you personally,
it
has to affect your view.
Yeah, it does. And in fact, I use that as an example. If you are driving along and you hit a roadblock, if I had family members that were traffic officers, I'd land up there and say, cool, these are people doing their job and all the rest of it. I just see it as harassment and say, you're putting more effort to recovering traffic fines than you are prepared to do to actually investigate a murders and that type of thing. And it just really reflects the way your life experience can actually interface with the situation. Two different people, same situation, and you'll have different reactions. And that's what, in a sense, one needs to understand about different people in terms of how they would react.
How did your parents cope with that?
Oh, it was very, very difficult. It certainly broke my father. My father since died, but my mother is also still. It's difficult. It's really, really, really very difficult for us to cope, because we really are quite a small family, and so it makes quite a big difference.
And you never thought, enough of this place, let me go and find somewhere else?
No. I'm rooted here. I really am, despite everything, you know, everything that's happened to me. I'm still very, very excited to be here. Doesn't mean that I'm not a critic or anything like that. I'm still very, very outspoken, but I'm a little bit more circumspect at the moment because of, out of the business that we started. I think we've started a business that is there to make a difference. That's the main thing, yeah.
Move on to 2016. Mm-hmm. During this period, you left ABSA, you went to Investment Solutions, in fact, wrote a book with Glenn Silverman.
We wrote that book when the BRICS were on the crest of the wave. We called it halfway there because we said it's not certain that they'll make it. We had the image that, you know, you get to halftime and you're winning, doesn't mean you're going to win the match, all right? And that the BRICS were winning at the time, but we picked up things that reflect some caution. We really outlined the strengths, the problems, and the decisions people had to make to actually get across the line, to actually get from halfway there to all the way there. And we can quite clearly see that the BRICS largely haven't got all the way there.
At that time,
yes,
you seemed to have everything going for you. There was Glenn, a colleague of yours.
Yes.
You wrote this amazing book, which took a lot of research. You traveled well to see it.
Yes.
You were often, we would talk on the radio, you were very outspoken, and you had total freedom of expression.
Yes.
And you then decide to join Standard Bank, a big corporate where there is a obvious history with big corporates that you got to be more confined and you've got to be more restricted in what you say. What possessed you to make that career change, or was it the big bucks?
Well, firstly, they headhunted me. Right, so it was nice to say, right, is this a step up and not? But one of the things in my interviews I said, and I made it very clear, that I'm a free spirit, as it were. And I've got that space at Investment Solutions, which is now Alexander Forbes Investment, a superb company, very happy there. There's, in other words, I'm sitting, minding my own business, and they came and headhunted, which is fine. And I said, you know, I am, one of the value adds that I bring is that I'm a independent thinker. When I speak to audiences, there's two common feedbacks that I get. The first is they understood what I said, and the second is that I actually reflected what I truly believed. In other words, I don't do the managed message, all right? And Standard Bank couldn't cope with it. In fact, they said that's exactly why they're calling me, because I was going into what's called wealth and investment. In other words, they're not there. High net worth individuals, it's their ultra high net worth individuals.
And they want the truth.
They don't buy the managed message. That's the end of the day, all right. And I landed there, and I think I was a hit immediately with their client base. I was already being overwhelmed with requests for presentations all over the place. But we had this political thing in the background. And the political thing in the background was another intersection, which I, again, discovered post the event, but I was suspicious of it at the time. And that is a deliberate, targeted hit, which is what actually had happened, with a bell-potting type of thing behind it. And it started off as the, I think, let me be careful, you know, because we've got certain agreements in place, but it certainly started off when Des van Rooyen was appointed as the Minister of Finance.
December 2015.
I was sitting on my bed on a Sunday night at about 11 o'clock, and my phone rings. And I thought, who the hell phones on a Sunday? All right. So I looked at it. It must have been literally as it was, I answered it. And it was a reporter wanting a comment on Pravin Gordhan becoming Minister of Finance.
This was after Des van Rooyen.
Yes, in other words, the weekend special.
And so now appointed. Sunday night comes Pravin.
So I wasn't even aware of this, and I had this gup, gup, gup sort of response, you know, because, it, you know, trying to get my thoughts together. you know, as to A, he's been fired. Something dramatic has happened, clearly. And I went on Twitter at that stage and I trended because I was saying it's fabulous because I've got a huge amount of respect for Pravin Gordhan as an able, competent person, but I'm highly critical of his tenure as finance minister because he took us into junk. Okay, his policies took us into junk in terms of ramping up debt, allowing... Anyway, we can argue that. But I walked into Standard Bank already. I had two interviews lined up later that day about that, and ice cold. Right? No further interviews on this at all. I say, then...
What happens there? Do you get instructed? Do you get
That was an absolute instruction, and I say
from
please,
where?
Please, from the top. Okay, and the reason is was I believe a good reason. Okay, in the sense that the heads of the bank had gone to Zuma and said you must change because the banks had taken strain, particularly you know, with their balance sheets and all the rest of it. The bond markets blowing up with the Des van Rooyen appointment. Basically, it was You said you wanted the minister changed. You've now got the change, and now your analysts are busy criticising the change. Right? So I say, fair. That's there's politics, etc. It's just sensible not to discuss. But they did, they did come and said, maybe you should just go off air for the next long while. And I thought, no, there was a lot that was happening, and people were expecting me to hear. So we said, we won't comment on these issues, and we'll keep back on that.
You're listening to the Alec Hogg Show from BizNews.
We were now heading to the municipal elections at that stage. The ANC knew they were in trouble and they needed to do two things. One, get critics out of the way. So you'll notice, for instance, that I was nailed, but other critical economists were also silenced. They were not asked. Davy Ruits and Mike Schussler's just... Their profiles just went
down. Underwater for a while.
And I can remember in 2017 or 18 or anywhere, it was one of, it doesn't really matter, sitting listening to a commentary on why the GDP was there. They were talking about the GDP coming out at 0.4 and the expectation was 0.6 growth and their expectation was like 0.5 and they were explaining why he was technically perfectly correct, and I had to turn it off because he wasn't talking about the naught. In other words, he wasn't talking about the thing that would matter.
Who's he?
I can't even remember who it was.
Some economist.
Okay, but it's this insipid commentary has been coming more and more, rather than actually getting to the real reason why we are heading into junk and deep into junk and continuing down the path because you've got praise singers or the managed message, and you can't say it like that, etc. Now, it's interesting because I actually believe that your analysts are, because you are conforming to the managed message and not what you think, is that you've got a serious problem if you had the FSCA investigating analysis as to whether you are complying with that big doctrine that you have to sign off, that it's independent thought, that you're not being influenced, that it is your real opinion. And that is nothing like that if you're coming off an institutional platform. And the other thing that shocked me almost to the core was how poor our journalism is. In other words, the media, I'm actually shocked because you do not get people who check their sources. And this, you could see, I think Donald Trump points this out. If you're not personally involved and it gets presented, you can't actually see it's fake news. But behind the, my gosh, anyway.
Where does that come from, do you think, Chris?
I don't know.
And do you think it's agenda managed or just incompetence?
I think there are agendas being pushed. I can't help thinking.
And useful idiots narrative, who are applying them.
Narratives that get pushed and people are getting paid. So it's the same thing as that you don't get people who ask the right questions, check their sources, give right of reply or anything like that. So you've got this what we call woke culture, all right? Cancel culture, which is then what I ran straight into. It becomes very toxic.
If I read the tweet that you made on a Sunday afternoon.
Yes.
Early January, so most people are on leave. I'm just going to read it again.
Yes.
More than 25 years after apartheid ended, the victims are increasing along with a sense of entitlement and hatred towards minorities.
Yes.
Now, certainly on BizNews, when you have a look at the comments and that, there was a misunderstanding of what was wrong with this. There was a Twitter storm that came out.
Yes.
Were you just minding your business one Sunday afternoon to tweet?
I was sitting at the beginning of the year. I thought, let me just put out a few things right to actually, and I actually got the whole sequence out. So in other words, there was a context of that tweet. But I've, you know, obviously that particular thing, I've had to look at it in its own, you know, out of context, and in other words, in its own right, and in the context of what I've been putting down. And I actually do not, I'd put it out again. Okay, to me, you've got snowflakes. A lot of it was a bell potting. They could have taken any of my tweets, if you like. They chose that one. Okay,
it was bell potting, Jeff?
I have a strong suspicion it was, or certainly related, because they used a lot of bots to. Mm-hmm. There was a lot of bots that started the actual.
Did it come out in Gupta leaks? Have you had a chance to check that?
No, I haven't done that. But it was part of that that thing, because the ANC needed to get rid of their critics, and they needed to change the narrative to actually say racism is the biggest issue of the municipal election, not service delivery, because they knew their own polls were telling them they were in trouble, and they lost the metros of Joburg, Pretoria, Port Elizabeth, etc. at that particular time. So they knew they were in trouble, but they had...
But this is 3rd of January. This is a Sunday.
3rd of January.
You're putting out what you think is going to happen in the year.
So I'm talking about, to my mind, the biggest issue, and there isn't a single biggest issue if you're actually properly prioritizing policy than unemployment in South Africa. I don't believe you've got poverty, inequality, and unemployment. I think you've got unemployment, which has poverty and inequality consequences. And that's the actual reason. Why do we have that unemployment rate? Is because we are going off on tangents and distractions.
But here's the tweet. So you then spend the next 4 hours debating it.
Yes.
Why?
So
why didn't you just disengage?
Right. Well, basically, I was trying to get this out, and I was also at that stage trying to be accessible as an economist on Twitter. So when people challenge me, I try and deal with it, and I'm trying to deal with it in an honest way, whereas in actual fact the attack was dishonest. It wasn't a genuine, other than I think you'll have some people that could say they were genuinely offended, but they were being caught up with with that. So
it was a Bell Pottinger war room that was
exactly
on full alert.
They were the ones that were busy punting that, and I know that because I haven't had any problems. And I do believe if I was genuinely racist, you know, that I would have had, you know, more problems than that. But it was really a one-off hit, you know, to do it. It's like, for instance, you want to get at the, pick a title, the current finance minister. So you trot out somebody who says, he raped me, you know, 20 years ago, etc. And he then has to resign, deal with it. You find out the allegations is rubbish, but you've achieved your goal. You've removed the person from their role because they've now had to focus on that.
But the bank blinked. This is the main thing and the whole story. As you go back to Standard Bank, you go through a disciplinary hearing.
Well, they threw me under the bus right at the beginning. You know, they put out a statement saying that they, you know, don't support this racism. They never, ever explained why this was racist.
Did you ever discover why?
Because I think, let me say, the corporate world is a bully and a coward. In other words, they are petrified of the image and they blinked to the mob. I took a view, and a lot of people said, I just rolled over and let Standard Bank do their thing, as I thought. What is my fight and my decision versus what somebody else's? Now, somebody else is saying, fight them. I'd still be fighting them, and they've got a lot more resources than I do, right? And it's, you know, not clear that you'd win, right? You know, there's David against Goliath, etc. They know that as well, so they can do that. And it's a pity because I really had fabulous colleagues there that I was getting to know, you know, very, very well.
How long had you been there?
I'd only been there 3 months, effectively. Wow. And I was enjoying the working environment as well, besides the, you know, managed message people coming to try and rein me in, I suppose.
Did you ever find out who appointed you or who was behind your appointment?
No. Obviously, I know who was appointed, but I don't think they appointed, you know, in other words.
Did they know
what
they were doing when you were appointed?
Yes,
I think that's the question.
They specifically, you know, I did establish they did want me there for my independent thought to actually interact with their clients on the basis that their clients were the ultra high net worth individuals that did not. Their managed message did not resonate with it, you know, that client base.
But there was a limit, clearly, to how far they were prepared to take it.
But I tell you, I'll give you another example of what happened, not at the time, but to somebody else, and that was Andrew Cantor, where he actually stood up and said
at Future Growth,
that's at Future Growth, and he actually stood up and basically said we can't invest in government because of the corruption, and from an investor point of view, it's just not. You know, it's not tenable. And he was castigated. Old Mutual also blinked and all the rest of it. As he pointed out, is where was the investment community and analyst community backing him? I felt the same, is that people were too scared to say anything. They wanted to help. You didn't know whether if somebody said something that would help or hinder and that kind of thing. So it is a difficult when you're dealing with a mob, right? It's a mob, you know. There's no rational thinking about that, and that's what you have to actually deal with.
I suppose.
With.
And the worst thing there is that it was really a bots mob. It was,
yes.
Wasn't it real?
Well,
not even a real mob.
No, there were some very real people that came in, and there were certainly some people that disappointed me enormously. Right, even some people I'd given money to that had actually climbed in, and I can't help thinking they were Trojan horses in my life. Anyway, so it was interesting in terms of learning who I could trust and who I couldn't trust. Very interesting, for instance, a lot of journalists at SABC and Gupta TV, around the back, you actually reached out and spoke and we interacted, gave me a lot more confidence in their individual integrity as journalists. Compared to some of the, let's call it private news thing, who were, you know, more woke and sort of jumping in on the bandwagon without any, you know, people who didn't at any stage phone and actually say, what did you mean? I didn't expect people to agree with me, but I would expect a journalist to check their source and at least give right of reply. You know, that's at least, you know, that's the least that one would expect as basic journalistic integrity, and that's where you realize it's just not there.
You're listening to the Alec Hogg Show from BizNews. It didn't take long for you to leave Standard Bank then. You resigned.
No. Yes.
Did they pay you handsomely to do that?
Nope. That was one of them, that couldn't be seen to be paying out. So we came to an agreement. A lot of it is confidential. And I'm happy, they're happy, and we carried on with our lives. And that was, to my mind, an excellent decision on my behalf. I went to actually start to pursue a dream of mine that I'd already started to formulate at Investment Solutions. I said, how can you mobilize institutional money into what I call the impact space? And I was one of the more prickly, I was chief strategist at Investment Solutions on the investment committee when people would come with what they call sustainable, responsible investing ideas. I would tend to be the person who chased them out the room. When I say chase them out, I say that figuratively. I always believe in being polite and that type of thing. But to me, we were managing 350 billion rand in pension money. I said, we're already managing all of it sustainably and responsibly. You know, what do you mean by sustainable and responsible investing? And usually they're meant a charity. In other words, we want to do wonderful things with your money, and intentions were noble, etc. But I said, you don't do that with pension money. Pensioners do not have a second chance. When they get to pension and we say, we've done wonderful things with your money, just terribly sorry about your pension. You know, you can't do that to somebody. You know, individuals can't take on the burden of society, of whatever you want to, you know, whatever you do. There are places for charity. I do not oppose charities, but pension money is not you know, not where you should be.
And what makes your company, Impact Investment Africa, of which I've got your business card in my hand, you are the executive chairman. What makes you different to those charities?
Is that we start off that anything that we try and apply investor money to must have a commercial merit. That's the starting off point, commercial merit. We then, you know, look at the other impacts. We specifically look at impacts that we believe are Africa relevant. In other words, jobs, food security, housing, education, and also business ownership. So we are looking to fund people into their businesses, not out of their businesses. That's one of the big problems that venture capital has, is that you come to me with a wonderful idea, say, we'll love your idea, we'll fund it, but we'll take 70% of your business. Now, you know, that to me defeats the object. And specifically, we're looking at generating business ownership in communities that do not necessarily have business ownership leadership skills, all right? And I can give an example. I go to Botswana a lot. I drive through a little town called Zeerust on the way, and then up north there's two little villages next to each other. There, in those little villages, there are no businesses. They're traditional villages, agrarian, and the nice houses that are being built there are because of people who've moved to Pretoria, getting a nice civil service salary, building a house back home, that type of thing. But if you get a formal job in the town, you have made it. All right, and that's the kind of thing we want to actually look to. See, can we actually get the business leadership to say, you go into business, you do well, and that's why you do well. And that gives the aspiration to other people in the community that you can be looked up to as a business person who is doing well because you are in business. You're doing drugs or, you know, that kind of thing.
How long have you been at it?
3 years now.
It's
been 3 years. We look in asset management. It's a case of it's almost like the person getting a job, right? You get a job when you've got experience, but you need a job to get experience. So you need assets under management to gain a track record, all right? But you can't get assets until you've got a track record. So we in a sense just emerging from that chasm as Impact. We've now gone into the Section 12J investing with what I call is a fairly unique model, and we've actually started to raise money for businesses in a fairly significant way. We're one of the few 12J asset managers that says you can bring any project you like and we'll try and raise funds for you. So we started off in August last year with this particular model with zero on the books. We went to 130 million by February.
Wow.
And for six projects, we've now got over 35 projects that we are on various stages of evaluation to actually come onto that to raise money. So we, in a sense, while businesses are being shut down and really are struggling because of this virus shutdown, we are actually experiencing a boom.
So you've got a good business going, Impact Investment. You're doing good there. I see your Twitter followers have gone from 25,000 in 2016 when the Twitter side occurred to 33,000 today. So you've got many more people following you. Are you still, I don't have to ask you, you are still out there. You are still very independent in your thought, and anybody who follows you on Twitter will see that.
Yes.
You haven't learned your lesson yet.
No, I still am tweeting, but I'm not engaging on Twitter, all right, because I think that's a mistake. You do it. If they like it, they like it. If they don't like it, the snowflakes must deal with it. Okay, that's it, et cetera. People know what their life experience is in this particular economy. We know we are in trouble. Okay, people must understand that. There's no way to sugarcoat that. And the route that we're going is, you know, I see what the Ramaphosa government and presidency is. I have seen no change in the direction from a point of view in principle, right, in terms of things like national health, things that will break the actual fiscal position. We're still going down that route.
Worse by COVID-19?
We were in trouble before this lockdown. We were already in recession, and it's almost like we're in recession and being plunged into depression. So 2.2 million jobs have been lost. And the problem is before this corona and I'm going to say hysteria, all right, and that's just my way of putting it, is that I would have accepted if they shut the economy down for a month to prepare, and then after that month you say, right, you now know what to do, you take responsibility for yourself. As the government, they can't protect me from normal crime. How the hell are they going to protect me from a virus? I mean, it goes beyond description, and I think we already know enough now that this has lower morbidity than normal flu and normal TB, and you know, which is transmitted in the same way. We didn't shut the economy down for those diseases at all. So, and then a whole heap of measures that are not fit for purpose, all right, immediately gives me a sense of, if it's not fit for purpose, what the hell is the purpose then for? So I don't trust what's going on. We don't have a government that we can trust. And that we can see even during the corona, the rampant corruption to the point of looting. It's not just skimming, right? I know people point to, but the nationalist government was also corrupt. They were skimmers. These are just, we just take the whole lot, you know, type of, there's no repercussions. So I look at this corona thing. 300,000 South Africans have been given fines for measures like not wearing a mask or something like that. Each fine comes with a criminal record. And during that whole time, how much effort has been put in to actually dealing with corruption? If anything, it just manifests itself over and over again with the contracts, the tenders that were, you know, put out. It just goes mad. So are we looking at a sort of Alice in Wonderland Mad Hatter's Tea Party?
And you still stay here, despite that view?
Well, I think because it is the land of my birth. I can't even find grandparents in my lineage on both my father's and mother's side that came from any other country than South Africa.
And why should you leave, I guess?
Exactly. If you're forced to leave, this could create a Twitter storm and say, what improvement did the current government make? And I don't see much in terms of improvement. In fact, I can see a lot of deterioration that is actually taking place. And that's basically when I look at this unemployment rate. I see in one end, at upper echelons of the party, the Bentleys, the Lamborghinis, and that kind of thing, that sheer excess that's occurring at that level, and the actual sheer the desperation, the misery that people are living in with their unemployment, etc. And I do believe that we can mobilize investment into this place. I think one of the things that, you know, in my business mind, etc., you'd say, you know where it says, I think in the Bible it says, you are the salt of the earth. But if salt loses its saltiness, you can just chuck it away and leave it on. I cannot help thinking that our financial institutions, our banks, have lost their saltiness. Certainly for the grassroots of our society. For the top 1%, it works very well. You know, if you're top 40 company, you've got access to the best credit, the best deposit rates, it's in no problems. But you go underneath there, there's increasingly a drought. And this is where we're trying to do as a financial institution. Might be small, but we're trying to actually get money back into the roots of the economy, right, where I do believe that there's a lot of opportunity. I look at this country and you say, we can look at all the buildings, all the roads, the cars, that we can double up on everything, all right? And that's what we need to do to actually accommodate everybody in the economy. If we want full employment, we have to double up on everything we have got. That is just massive opportunities if we just have a government that would not be a business prevention government. Okay, that's basically what we've got, is that we've got too much business prevention measures in place to actually do it. And one of the things in economics, it's not, and there's not a lot of absolutes, but one of the absolutes we can have is that there is no other source of wealth creation in an economy, in a society, other than through business activity. Some sort of enterprise business activity is where the value chain starts. Okay, and very often when I listen to even academics, etc., when they're talking, you can hear they have no clue as to the actual source of their wealth.
When will the penny drop? What's it going to take?
I don't think it is, because the discussion is too. Firstly, I don't think there's a single person in Parliament that I know of that actually understands an economic issue at all. Right, it's all social justice issues. And then, of course, you've got this insipid commentary which won't actually tell the truth, you know, in terms of what is the actual real problem in the economy. And you've got ideological, you know, distortions, you know, where you've got Marxists, failed Marxist policies being pushed very, very hard. And that seems to be these funny little think tanks that are around that are actually quite close to the policy making.
So what happens then, Chris, if you have this view of the world?
We're going to continue going into decline as an overall economy. That doesn't mean I, as an individual, need to actually just accept it. I do believe as an individual, I understand what's going on. And I think I can leverage off the opportunities that actually presents. But I wish it was understood, you know. But I don't believe that we're going to actually see that.
So what gets you up in the morning if you have this pretty gloomy outlook for the country as a whole?
Well, because I'm not. I use the image. If you look at a situation, you'll be pessimistic or optimistic about it, and that's when you look at it. If you look through it, you see the opportunities that the circumstances actually present. So, in markets, I'll give you an example. For instance, if you said we're going into a huge boom, if your portfolio is sitting with bonds, that's a disaster because bonds do badly in a boom. All right. Whereas if you say we're going into this, you know, big long decline, right, the opportunity is bonds. Okay, there's an opportunity that comes out of a set of circumstances that you need to actually, if you can describe it accurately, it's important to actually do it.
So where are we going? If you can look back in 5 years.
We're taking the slow cooker route because the Ramaphosa effect is that it shored up confidence, but I believe falsely so, and that the Ramaphosa effect has actually slowed it down, which is probably the worst. I actually rooted for Nkosi Sizana Dlamini Zuma to come in because you would have probably seen the last election minority and the need for a coalition government. Okay, that's what would have happened. But he shorted up, which meant that we sapped the strength and capability and capacity of the economy slowly over time. Rather, if you go into deep, quick downturn, you've still got the capability and capacity for the actual resurgence, but we may end up at the end of the line with our best talent and all that immigrated and the very difficult path back up to, you know, where we could have been.
You've been listening to another BizNews production. Be sure to catch all our podcasts by subscribing to BizNews Radio on iTunes, Spotify, Amazon, or by visiting biznews.com. I'm Alec Hogg. Until the next time, cheerio.